This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Is democracy at hand in Europe's last dictatorship? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Shortly after what was widely viewed as a fraudulent and rigged election in Belarus on August 9, thousands of citizens peacefully took to the streets in the capital Minsk and elsewhere to protest. Despite a violent crackdown by security forces, which killed at least two people, beat many others, and detained more than 7,000, Belarusians remained in the streets to this day to protest the rigged outcome. President and authoritarian strongman Alexander Lukashenko, who has been in power since 1994, shortly after the former Soviet Republic of Belarus gained independence, falsely announced that he had garnered 80% of the vote, defeating his rival, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who was forced to flee to neighboring Lithuania for her and her children's safety. In reality, according to The Economist magazine, quote, the true result is unknowable, but in a few polling stations where rigging was prevented by observers, she won about 70%. So what has been the role of Lithuania and other former Soviet republics and Eastern European nations in reaction to this travesty of justice? What about Western Europe and the United States? What are the prospects for Europe's last dictatorship finally coming to an end? We'll ask our distinguished guests. Stephen Nix is Regional Program Director for Eurasia at the International Republican Institute, or IRI, where he oversees programs in Belarus, Ukraine, Georgia, the Kyrgyz Republic, Moldova, Russia, and Ukraine. Prior to joining IRI in 2000, Stephen Nix served for 2 years as Senior Democracy Specialist at the U.S. Agency for International Development. And Laura Jewett. She is Senior Associate and Regional Director for Eurasia Programs at the National Democratic Institute, or NDI. Before joining NDI, Laura Jewett served on the staffs of two U.S. Democratic senators in the state of Connecticut. It is an honor for us to host both senior experts from these organizations whose goal is to support and strengthen democratic institutions across the globe and to foster greater citizen participation, accountability, and openness in government. And both panelists join me via Skype as we continue to practice social distancing. Stephen Nix, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me today, Carol.
And Laura Jewett from NDI, welcome to you.
Thank you, Carol. It's good to be here.
First to you, Stephen Nix. Were you surprised at the massive popular protests that erupted in Belarus after what is widely seen as a rigged election?
Well, I can't say we were surprised, because going into this particular election cycle, we sensed that there was a change electorate developing in Belarus. And we saw this by the attention and the emergence of some new players to the scene. First was Tikhanovsky, a blogger, Sepkala, Babariko, people who hadn't been associated with the democratic forces or the opposition political parties in Belarus. So these were relative newcomers who were drawing huge crowds, and all based on a platform of change for Belarus. And that was a message that resonated among these people. So we knew that this election might be different. And in terms of the protests, I think all of us will agree that we were amazed and astounded at the scope of these protests, the numbers, the passion that people are exhibiting. Belarusians finally are casting aside what we described as a fear society and are no longer afraid to speak up.
Laura Jewett, let me ask you the same question. To what extent you may have been surprised at the massive popular protests that erupted right after the election results were announced in Belarus?
It has been fascinating to watch. And I think the big takeaway for me is that these events have been a reminder to never discount the democratic aspirations of a population. There has long been an assumption about Belarusians that they had sort of grown accustomed to President Lukashenko and that they were a conservative and kind of risk-averse group, that they preferred stability over uncertainty. But as Steve says, both IRI and NDI have done research in Belarus, and we found starting really 5 years ago that there was this change electorate that he referred to that was emerging. These are people who were dissatisfied with the status quo and who were open to political change as a solution. And earlier this year, as the election approached, it became clear that this change electorate was growing and becoming more politicized and politically active than ever before. And we saw this during the election campaign. As Steve said, new faces came out as candidates. Citizens stood in hours-long lines to sign registration forms for opposition candidates, and they turned out in the tens of thousands for opposition campaign rallies. And then when Lukashenko, seeing this and understanding that he was losing support, blatantly rigged the election, and then through repression and violence, both before and during and after Election Day, this only added fuel to the momentum. And I think that the takeaway, again, as I say, is to never underestimate the degree to which people want to be treated with dignity and with justice and integrity. Because what started as a sort of a spontaneous movements in support of a democratic election has now become a real movement in support of democracy.
Let's talk more about that movement. And back to you, Stephen Nix. What do we know about Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who is actually an accidental candidate because she stood in for her husband, who is a popular vlogger, who was jailed to prevent him specifically from running? And talk about her and the nature and the tenor of the protests. We're seeing such a cross-section, many women, very peaceful.
Yes. Well, we all know, as you put it, she was not the intended candidate. 3 months ago, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya was a homemaker and a part-time school teacher. And as a result of the incarceration of her husband, who was aspiring to be a candidate for president, she stepped into that role. Reluctantly, but she felt she needed to do it to support her husband, but also to support the people of Belarus. So this is a very brave woman to take on this role, because now she has campaigned on a platform of change. Her message of change has resonated. You saw that, as was pointed out, during the long lines of people who were willing to sign petitions for her candidacy, and then the very long lines on Election Day to cast votes. And remember, those long lines are important because during her campaign of change, she asked her supporters not to turn out during Belarus's 5 days of early voting and instead cast their ballots on Election Day, which is more evidence of the fact that the election count was completely falsified. Let me just go into some of the methodologies. 5 days of early voting in Belarus. And those of us who've worked on Belarus for many, many years know that the early voting is not supervised. It's not really allowed to be observed by international or domestic observers. We know that the ballot boxes for early voting sit for 5 days, unsecured, unguarded. And we have anecdotal evidence to support the fact that when these boxes are not occupied or are not secured in the evening, that commission members merely go in and stuff the ballot box. So tremendous amount of fraud in this election. But back to Svetlana. She's taken on this role. And as Laura pointed out, the election aftermath has transformed into a national movement, a movement for change that's making some very discreet demands. Svetlana is asking that the current president step aside, that new elections be held, and that all political prisoners be released, and for the authorities to stop the beating and incarceration of peaceful protesters. So you've got this remarkable woman thrust into this role who, in my opinion, has performed very admirably. The task becomes even more difficult because she's leading this movement from Vilnius, Lithuania, where she had to flee for her own personal safety and for her children.
Turning back to you, Laura, for anything to add or subtract to what we know about the movement and the demands, which Stephen very nicely delineated, and the other tactics that are being used, whether it's this creation of the National Coordination Council, the use of Telegram to communicate among the protesters, strikes, and so forth.
Yes, I completely support what Steve has said and would simply add that this movement has really been remarkable in so many ways. It has been incredibly diverse and inclusive. It includes women and young people, pensioners, factory workers, techie types, artists, journalists, students, athletes, moms, dads, kids, and people from every part of the country. It's not just the capital in Minsk, but in cities and small towns and villages, people are protesting. So the country is united as it never has been before, and it's united on behalf of democracy. The movement has also been, I think, remarkable for its peacefulness. The demonstrators themselves have been peaceful, which can't be said of the state security forces. It has also been very creative. It has been a decentralized movement, although the candidate Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is regaining sort of her leadership of it. But the protests have emerged organically, and they have involved music and huge flags. Traditional Belarusian flag has been brought out as an important symbol. Women dressed in white carrying flowers, all kinds of videos and signs, human chains, a lot of humor, very artistic. And I think 6 months ago, I would not have anticipated that Belarus would be an inspiration to the world, in not just that it's demonstrating for democracy, but in the way that it has. NDI's chairman, Madeleine Albright, often says in her books and in her speaking that it took her a long time to find her voice, and so she's not going to be silent now. And I feel a little bit like that's what's happened with Belarus. They've found their voices now, and it is a very clear and kind of beautiful voice, and they won't be silenced anymore.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. And joining me via Skype are my guests, Stephen Nix. He's Regional Program Director for Eurasia at the International Republican Institute, or IRI, and Laura Jewett, from whom you just heard, Senior Associate and Regional Director for Eurasia Programs at the National Democratic Institute, or NDI. And we're discussing the significance and implications of the pro-democracy protests in Belarus. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to Twitter follower Gregorio Dimitri from Manduria, Italy. If you want to hear your name on the air, please leave a comment on our Facebook page at Carol Castiel VOA or send an email to encounter@voanews.com. So let's get back to our program. Back to you, Stephen Nix, because I'd like you to talk about the significance of this moment from a geopolitical standpoint, this last sort of dictatorship in Europe. We know that Lukashenko has a very close relationship to Putin. We know there are some problems, but talk about how incredible this is at this moment, and what kind of a threat does this popular movement pose to Lukashenko's survival, and what do we know about Russian President Vladimir Putin's reaction to what is going on?
Well, to put this in context for your viewers, Lukashenko has been in power for 26 years and has maintained power through three primary levers. First is complete domination and control of state-run television. No one from the democratic forces, the opposition, receives any time on television. That's been the case. Complete domination of TV. Second is this contract with the Belarusian people in a state-dominated economy where pensions and salaries were delivered to people. And in return, people were willing to waive or forgo certain basic human rights. Again, that was to maintain stability among the population. And the third lever of power that he's utilized is repression. Whenever the democratic forces emerged, that movement was crushed. We saw that in 2010 after the elections, brutal crackdown. So repression remains the third and very vital tool in the Lukashenko repertoire. So based on these three things, he's remained in power. Now we have this very organic movement nationally. I would say that these three levers of power have also changed. First, our research shows that social media has caught up with and surpassed, in fact, the main source from which people obtain political news. And that, in turn, has enabled the opposition, people like Svetlana, to get their message of change out through social media. And secondly, this social contract with the Belarusian people has broken down because the economy has broken down. Russia has refused to continue to subsidize oil and gas, which, as we all know, were entities that Lukashenko used then to resale in European markets, balance his budget. And that leaves him, if TV disappears as the main source of control and the social contract, the economy, is breaking down, that lever has disappeared. That leaves Lukashenko with the third remaining lever, and that's repression. And you're seeing that played out now in the aftermath of these elections. I don't believe power can be sustained merely by repression. Your second point, the analogies to other revolutions and neighboring countries, particularly Russia. I would say that Belarus is very distinct from the revolution of dignity in Ukraine. First and foremost, this is a very domestic affair. Belarusians are not demanding membership in EU as the Ukrainians did. They are merely asking for change. They want a change in leadership. So the parallels to Ukraine, I don't think, are that particularly persuasive. These people want change. They want a change in leadership, want a change in the economy, in their judicial system. And that's what they're asking for. This group, we have research that shows that the population basically wants both good ties with the European Union, the West, but also wants to maintain very strong economic, historical, and cultural ties with Russia. They want good relations with both. That poses no threat to Russia whatsoever. So I think that distinguishes the Belarus case very distinctly from the Ukraine case.
Turning back to you, Laura Jewett, for your take on what kind of a threat this poses to the leadership of Lukashenko and the impact on Russia. I definitely take Stephen's point about the fact that this is a domestic affair, which makes it different. It's not a so-called color revolution like Ukraine and other former Soviet republics in Belarus. But nonetheless, it seems to me that it poses a big threat to Lukashenko's power, obviously, and even that of Putin. But let me get your take on that.
Yes, I agree with Steve. I think the threat to Lukashenko is mortal. That doesn't mean that he can't reimpose control through force, as Steve has said, but it is very, very difficult to maintain control over a population exclusively through force. And this is a population that we've just discussed has determined that they are united in support of democracy. And I think it's hard to put that toothpaste back in the tube again. I don't think Belarusians will quietly go back to their homes and give up the struggle that they've begun. So I think for Lukashenko, I don't know if he's aware of it yet, but I think the circumstances, as Steve said, have changed for him dramatically. And for the Kremlin, it's a problem symbolically and for other reasons. Belarus is important to Russia. I think the Kremlin sees Belarus as kind of being in Slavic brotherhood with Russia. And there's also a fear that what happens in Belarus could spill over and have a demonstration effect in Russia. So I can't pretend to know how Vladimir Putin thinks, but if I try hard to put myself in his shoes, I'd be concerned watching what's happened. Putin and Lukashenko quite famously don't get along very well. And if I were Putin, I would be uneasy about propping up a deeply unpopular and prickly authoritarian leader on my neighborhood. I think that's not something that is probably seen in the Kremlin's interest. What they'll do, I don't know. But I think for them, there are no easy answers here. And simply propping up Lukashenko is not a great choice for Russia.
Back to you, Stephen Nix. There are no easy answers and we can only speculate, but let's try to do that as we close. How would you assess the role of Lithuania in particular and then other Eastern European states? How have they reacted to what's going on in Belarus, particularly the movement to promote democracy? And what about the Western nations? What kind of influence can these states, as well as the United States, because we know that U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Stephen Biegun met with Svetlana recently to show U.S. support. What can all of these parties do to help the forces for change and to make a difference?
Well, again, I think general support from both Europe and the United States to support Svetlana in her efforts to represent the voices of the Belarusian people. And again, to try to emphasize their demands, which are stepping aside of the current president, new elections, release of political prisoners, and the end to violence of those who are peacefully demonstrating. So the EU has come out, and Lithuania in particular, in support of these goals. And there's been a discussion in the European Union about the possibility of sanctions, both individual and sectoral sanctions. I think those are positive developments. I think it's critical that the United States link up and coordinate with the European Union if sanctions are imposed so that there is a united front. And it's also important that there be some dialogue or negotiation. At present, Lukashenko has stated that he refuses to negotiate with any outside entities. But I think that's critical. I think that the movement will be sustained. I think people will continue to protest. But the West has an important goal here to give voice and support to those aspirations of the Belarusian people. And that means continuing to support their goals and the possibility of economic sanctions on Belarus.
So back to you, Laura Jewett, for your take on the role of the West, the United States in particular, as well as probably more so Europe? And actually, what are the obstacles in your view as well? We know that the security forces are still on the side of Lukashenko. Maybe a few have defected, but that has got to be a major obstacle for substantive change.
As Steve said, I think the international community, including Europe and the US, has a tremendous and very, very urgent responsibility right now to engage on this issue more, I think, than they have engaged so far. And first and foremost, the fundamental principle is that we should be supporting and respecting the agency of the Belarusian people themselves and their aspirations and supporting their demands. And as Steve has said, I think the international community should reflect the demands of the people of Belarus, which is to end state violence against the peaceful protesters and release political prisoners and detainees, hold new elections that would be held under a reformed electoral framework and with observation from credible international and domestic observers, sanction individuals who are responsible for the state violence, the repression, and the election fraud, and refuse to recognize the official election results. In addition, I think there needs to be additional support to the Belarusian democratic community, which includes political parties and social movements, civic initiatives, bloggers, YouTube channels, journalists who are operating on Telegram, so that there is a way for the democratic community to communicate. And I think some of those things are happening, but much more is needed, including also, as Steve said, making sure that there is some process for mediation to support a peaceful transition.
As we close, so back to you, Steve and Nix. Both of you have articulated that this is an indigenous movement. This came from the people of Belarus, but obviously Lukashenko and Putin always blame the outside, blame foreign powers like the United States and Western Europe and even Lithuania, saying that troops are being massed along the border, which is, of course, false. So as we close, how optimistic are you that the kinds of measures you both outlined can be taken in favor of this popular movement to move Belarus toward democracy? And what do you see as obstacles or possible pitfalls?
I would say that first and foremost, that the movement needs to be sustained. We think that Svetlana Tikhanovskaya has done a remarkable job of doing that from a foreign country. I don't think that the Belarusian people are going to be willing to return to the old ways. I think the fear society has been cast aside. I think you'll see this movement sustained and, quite frankly, be strengthened over the coming months. So the key really is, with the movement ongoing, will Lukashenko or others around him in the government be willing to negotiate and to try to reach some settlement which would meet the demands of the Belarusian people? I really think that time is on the side of the Belarusian people here. I don't want to get overly optimistic, but as I said before, Lukashenko is relying on his only remaining lever of power, and that's repression. I don't believe that that can be sustained over time.
And Laura Jewett, you get the last word. Are you equally cautiously optimistic as Steve and Nix that the movement can be strengthened, that they will not go back and tolerate any type of repression? And will Putin leave his little green men inside Russia and not try to prop up Lukashenko?
I have great confidence in the people of Belarus. I cannot predict what the Kremlin will or will not do. I think it's in the interest of the international community to very quickly and urgently step in and engage in support of the demands of the Belarusian community. My concern is that the international community may be distracted by other things that are going on around the world and in the U.S., things that are happening domestically, and that may inhibit our willingness to step up. And I also have a concern that maybe using a geopolitical lens may interfere with the international community's ability to understand that this issue is about Belarusians and what Belarusians want and deserve. I hope that those concerns won't be realized.
On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Stephen Nix. He's Regional Program Director for Eurasia at the International Republican Institute, and Laura Jewett, Regional Director for Eurasia Programs at the National Democratic Institute. Thanks so much to both of you for your terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.